Welcome to Sinopenia, the podcast of the Center for International Security and Strategy, CISS, at Tsinghua University. We provide Chinese perspectives with a global vision. I'm Dawei, the director of CISS, speaking from Beijing.
And I'm Shelly Qing from the Shanghai Institutes for International Studies, co-hosting today from Beijing. We are delighted to have with us Dr. Zhao Hai, Director of International Political Studies at the National Institute for Global Strategy, who attended the World Economic Forum in Davos in this January. Today, we'll explore his on-the-ground observations, the state of transatlantic relations, the evolving international order, and of course, China's perspective.
Hi, hello everyone. This is Zhao Hai. I'm the Director of International Political Studies at the National Institute for Global Strategy. Right now, I'm speaking from Helsinki. It's a pleasure to join Sinopenia again.
Okay, thank you, Zhao Hai. Let me start with you. You have had some time to reflect since January after Davos. So looking back at Davos, what is the one thing that stayed with you the most strongly? Was it a particular session, for example, or perhaps a conversation with somebody that really shaped your thinking about the current global moment?
In Davos, there are so many things happening at the same time. Even though it's only three short days, but there are so many events. I met so many people. It's hard to say one or two things standing out, but apparently the one thing that is really smeared in my mind is President Trump hosting the establishment of the Board of Peace. You have more than, I think, 20 countries present, and the president himself chaired this whole event. And I was present pretty close to the president and also a series of American officials, including the Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of State, Secretary of Commerce. They're all present. It looks like a very splendid event to celebrate the establishment of the board and also Trump's personal victory. However, this whole event feels very strange because I was sitting among the audience and there are all kinds of sounds emerging from the audience when President Trump is calling for this board to manage global affairs, and also in particular when his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, coming up to present a few slides of PPT showing Gaza, a completely destroyed Palestinian land that will be imagined or reimagined to be established as a sort of Riviera of the future. So this whole experience, it's at the one time quite shocking, but on the other hand, sometimes you feel ironic and even humorous.
That's a great place to start, Zhao Hai. I wish I was there too. But much of the talk at Davos and Sinks has been about the Greenland issue and the tensions it's exposed between the United States and Europe. So from your direct conversations there, did you sense that the European participants view this as a temporary dispute or as a sign of something more fundamental shifting in the alliance?
No, this is definitely not temporary or one-off event. From my observation, you can see clearly that this Davos event is all about Greenland for European leadership. Before Trump before his arrival, basically, there's a number of leadership speech in which von der Leyen is talking about Greenland, but also Ukraine and European affairs. And also after that, you have the very famous Carney Doctrine coming out. And then right after Trump, there's also German Chancellor speaking. So a group of French President Macron also spoke at the event. If you combine their speeches together, you can see a very clear line of using Greenland as a departure point for European politics and transatlantic relationship. I think the fundamental problem is not what happens to Greenland, but the trust between the United States and the Europeans. And once that trust is no longer there, Europeans were forced to reconsider their position, their alliance with the United States, and their future moving forward. They presented a number of solutions, and on top of that, of course, it's Carney Doctrine. However, there's extensive talks about for Greenland itself, how to push back against the United States, and for European defense, how to build up the defense for the coming years, and also in particular for European competitiveness, how to massively invest in the for the future of European industries. You can see a lot of confusion, a lot of concerns, a very deep anxiety, and a very active search for solutions. However, so far, because of American pressure and because of this very condensed threat from all over in European eyes, so far, I don't think they've found the solution yet.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned trust as the key word here. So how do you view it, Dawei?
I think I'm very much agree with Zhaohai on his view. I also think this is not a short-term dispute. It's I think what the Trump administration has done seriously damaged the trust across the Atlantic. Having said that, I feel also a little bit uncertain about the capability of the European side to achieve the strategic autonomy. Of course, I think what has happened in Greenland, I think, was like a kind of wakening up call for Europe. I think now the European countries understand that they need to achieve this independence or autonomy. But in the short term, at the same time, I don't think they have the capability to achieve that. On the one hand, I think it will be a big, economic and a fiscal challenge for the European countries to build their security capability, and also it's a long-term thing to build their, for instance, defense industry at home. And on the other hand, I think the Europe or EU, put it in that way, is we know this EU is not a one country. It's so many 27 countries together. So it's not a very effective, very unified organization or body. So it could be very slow, and the different countries, different European countries, different part of Europe, let's say East Europe, West Europe, South Europe, North Europe, I think they have different policy agendas. So I think European colleagues understand it's quite challenging for them to achieve this independence or autonomy. So because of this contradiction, on the one hand, they want to be independent. On the other hand, they are not able to achieve it in the short run. I heard a lot of, people in Europe. I was not in Davos, but I did talk to many European colleagues in recent weeks. I think some of them may say, I hope it could be a temporary dispute. Some others may say, okay, we will achieve that, but they cannot give me a very, plausible action of the plan of action. So this is my understanding. So Yuqun,
just jump in please. Here for a very quick a comment is that when Trump gives a speech, the most critical moment comes when he said he does not want to use force against Greenland. And you can hear on the ground that people are so relieved. So I think for many Europeans, the key point is whether or not the transatlantic relationship, particularly NATO, will fall apart because of the threat of use of force on the U.S. part against Greenland. But at this moment, at this point, I think Trump is being either pushed back by Europeans or persuaded by his own team not to threaten Europe with military force. However, I don't think Trump at this point has given up the idea of annexing Greenland at all. So I think, again, this problem will persist. If any Europeans say that this problem has been solved or will be taken off the table, I think they're dreaming.
Yeah, I think what you said is quite interesting, that this sense of relief actually shows, you know, the very difficult and self-contradictory attitude among the Europeans on this issue. So, Yuqing, let me ask you, but I want to, you know, change the perspective from, you know, more or less a European perspective to the U.S. So how much do you think from the American perspective, from the U.S. perspective, is that a long-term thing, or it's a structural thing, or it's a short-term thing? Let's imagine, you know, if, you know, after 3 years, if the political leadership changes in Washington, so is that repairable? Is this relationship repairable? I mean, transatlantic relationship.
It's quite interesting that if we look at from the U.S. perspective, actually, what has changed the most is the domestic politics in the United States and its huge implications for the transatlantic relations. So, of course, this current U.S. Administration style is very, very unique. And that has caused a lot of surprise and anxiety in Europe. So after this administration, what about the next? If, for example, the Democrats come back, will the next U.S. administration's policy be kind of a very polite to their European counterparts? Or if there is another Republican president, U.S. president, that will he or she have the same Trump style? We just don't know. It's unpredictable at the current stage. But all these things are style things. And if we look at the structural change or the longer term, I would say the United States overall, its power, its strength is declining. And this is the first thing. The second is its global strategy. The focus of U.S. Global strategy is moving toward the East. I don't think that will change. So these two things have very much implications for transatlantic relations. That's why the United States has continually asked the European counterparts that you have to take more burden by yourselves. Don't depend on the United States to do all those things. You have to defend yourself. But the challenge is actually, I think, on the European side, whether they would, just like Dawei, you said previously, whether they are capable to do that, or they have the political consensus to do that. So far, I think it's still a question mark.
Well, I think at this point, there's a divide. There's no they, I think, in Europe, because from my sense, I talked to a group of people in Davos. They have different views. Some people thinking critically about Europeans themselves and say, you know, Trump maybe done the right thing by pushing the Europeans to spend more on their own defense and shoulder more of their own responsibilities. And some say that Trump's behavior equals basically dismantle the pillar of NATO and bring down the transatlantic alliance. So I think it depends on which standpoint you're looking at this transition. But let's come back to both of you. The Prime Minister Carney of Canada spoke powerfully at Davos, I think, about middle powers needing to step up and form a third sort of polar, or organizing at the third party against a great power rivalry. Do you think this vision of middle power solidarity is practical or likely?
I will say, first of all, I want to say I like Prime Minister Carney's speech very much. That was a beautiful and eloquent speech. Having said that, I'm a little bit suspicious to the Europeans, you know, capability to unite together to achieve the goal. I'm even more skeptical to this middle power at the third polar or the block thing. I think it's quite difficult. I mean, Canada, I mean, I don't know which country are in this group, but I think Canada, Australia, and maybe some other Asian countries like Japan, plus Europe, could all be put in this category. But I think all of them are very difficult, different, and also I think all these countries, of course, they have their own interests, and moreover, I think different countries have their different relations with the United States. For example, I think the Asian allies' relations with the U.S. is so far okay, I will say, better than the transatlantic relationship. So I don't know if those countries will be, you know, East Asian country will join this bloc as Carney suggested. Including Canada and other European countries, they are facing the challenges of, for example, economic challenges from the U.S. and from China. I think different countries will more or less adopted some kind of, I call it economic nationalism or nationalist economic policy. So they can, I think it's quite hard for them to coordinate their policy. I don't know if I'm too pessimistic. So maybe Yu Quan have, you know, some brighter answer.
Middle power, the concept of middle power has been there for quite a long time, right? And if my memory is right, just like 2 or 3 years ago, I was in Japan. Yeah, I was talking with a Japanese professor. He just came back from a conference of middle power, and I asked him results from this conference, and he said the middle power is dead. We just can do nothing. So I was very much impressed by his conclusion. So Prime Minister Carney's remarks at Davos, of course, it was kind of welcomed by the audience very much. But I think when he mentioned middle powers, the versus those hegemons, China is one of the hegemons, right? China, US, the two big powers, are at the opposite side of the so-called middle powers. But it's quite interesting because I think the concept of middle powers is kind of a very vague. The size, of course, is smaller than those hegemons or great powers. So they have their common interests, which is try to counter those hegemons or those great powers. But then, beside that, they have a lot of different interests determined by their different geopolitical positions, their different development phases, their different relations with those China and US, with those so-called great powers. And then they have very different political systems, ideologies. So I think it's a kind of ad hoc cooperation. For example, on specific issues like AI governance, whether those mid powers can cooperate together to deliver or to propose a new AI governance framework, or in their negotiations with those big powers, whether they will be they will have enough leverage or not. All those things are very practical issues. And I don't think, of course, political speeches are great, right? Especially at the current stage, Prime Minister looks like a hero. But if you talk about those specific issues on the practical level, on the policy level, I think there will be a lot of challenges coming out for those middle powers.
I think it's kind of Canada can say no. Carney's proposition is more like the West minus U.S. However, without the U.S., the Western system is no longer a Western system. And also, if without the United States, all the middle powers coming together will face the number one problem, right, is the collective decision problem. Who's going to lead the group? Who's going to make the ultimate decisions? Which direction will they go?
Right.
It's just like, yeah, right. Just like Dawei has described, North, East, West, South, I mean, different kind of Europe will have different ideas of what to do on defense, on economy, on a lot of things. And also Australia may have very different national interests than Canada. They may share the same kind of ideology or value, but the West without the U.S., it's just, I don't think they can be successful.
But there is another, because recently I had a conversation with some European colleagues, and I said, since there are so many disputes between the United States and European countries, that the concept the Chinese used to say, which is 美西方, right, the United States and the Western countries, is no more there. Because you are so, you fight, quarrel with each other. So there is no more a unified 美西方. And then some European colleagues said that, no, that doesn't necessarily mean there is no 美西方. Because after so many decades, European countries and the United States, they are integrated with each other systematically. There are so many mechanisms between the United States and EU and European countries. There are so many people-to-people exchanges. Those concepts, those proposals, you know, these two sides, they have been integrated into one system for so many years. So I guess just one Trump administration is not able to break the transatlantic relationship. Perhaps we need, it's a joke, perhaps we need five or 10 to break this transatlantic relations. Yeah.
I think that's very, you know, very interesting observation. It's like the rift between the two sides across the Atlantic is like a divide in a family. They are kind of, you know, very close family relationship. So then I have a very vital question for you. Actually, I read all these reports from the Western medias. There have been a lot of discussion. So like particularly in recent weeks, we have seen in Beijing, many European leaders, and also, of course, Carney himself, Canadian Prime Minister, are visiting China, and there will be more. This week the British Prime Minister has been here in China. So the question is, from China's perspective, what does this transatlantic dynamics and Europe and the West's internal debate mean? I mean, we have seen this increasing diplomacy towards towards Beijing, towards China. In your analysis, is this primarily a tactical hedge against the U.S.? Or like Zhao Hai said, Canada can say no, or Europe can say no thing? Or could it lead to a more strategic realignment among the major powers? So Zhao Hai, what's your sense from this ground?
I don't think Europeans are ready for strategic realignment. And with the war in Ukraine still going on, with this current complicated international arena, right now, if you look at recently what EU has been doing, not individual European countries, they're signing free trade agreements with Latin America, and then most importantly, recently, with India. So they're diversifying their relationship with other parts of the world. Instead of just realigning or getting closer to China strategically. So I would say that right now, these recent diplomatic activities reflect a tactical hedge against U.S. unpredictability, and particularly against the Trump administration's policies toward Europe. And if you look at the past year, I mean, think about this. Trump is only in power for 1 year, but we feel like it's been so long. However, just in very short 1 year, Trump launched trade war against the world. And only China stand up against the United States. So right now, in order to push back against the U.S., I think the only viable approach, of course, pragmatically, also strategically, is try to have a better pragmatic relationship with China and hedge against the U.S. For long-term strategic realignment, I think Yuqing just mentioned, you need a longer stretch of American current America First foreign policy or MAGA foreign policy. And also you need a bigger difference, a fundamental difference, ideological difference between Europe and America to have a more equal relationship between Europe, United States, and China. So at this point, I don't think that has been accomplished yet.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with Zhao Hai's view that I think it's a kind of a tactical hedge against the Trump administration. And also, those visits to China could help those European administrations and also Canadian government to have more leverage when they are trying to have negotiation with the U.S. Administration. And then besides Ukraine war, of course, those European countries have a lot of complaints about China on economic and trade issues and industrial policy. All those things are still on the table. But I think for those countries, one thing is very important, because President Trump is going to visit China in this coming April. And it's quite interesting that he criticized UK and Canada for their leaders visiting China, right? So I guess those European countries and also Canada, they don't want to stay aside when the United States take a lot of things from the Chinese big market, but they are just stand aside, get nothing. So that's also very important in their calculation on their visit to China, I guess.
Yes, I think I share a lot of view with you, but I want to give you two more direct and maybe provocative question related to the earlier discussion. Do you think this changes, transatlantic relation changes, do you think it's a good thing for China or a bad thing for China? Is that an opportunity that China can utilize? Or you think it's hardly to say an opportunity? And if it's an opportunity, what can China do? What should China do to grab this opportunity?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, for now, I would consider this an opportunity and also a very precious opportunity that open up a short-term strategic window for China to reset its relationship with a number of major European powers. Because of what happened between Ukraine and Russia, China's relationship with Europe has been damaged. And also because of the United States, of previous administration, trying to bring Europe on board to contain China, the relationship has been cooling down for years. You can see from the recent visits, the British Prime Minister hasn't been in China for 8 years. And also, if you look at Finland, Canada, and many other countries, their top leadership has rarely come to China and also has rarely reached agreement at this level. So I think this is a very good opportunity to warm up the relationship, to renegotiate trade relations, to reset political relationship. So yes, I consider this very much a opportunity. However, like Yuqing has described, I think there's concerns. If you come out and talk to leaders and particularly business leaders in Davos, they have a very prominent concern about China's economy, and they always say the word overproduction, state subsidy, industrial policy. And also, if you talk about last year, one of the major news, of course, is China's export surplus had reached over $1.2 trillion, which is a major headline. So moving forward, I think, again, I want to emphasize the importance and the importance of Vice Premier He Lifeng's speech in Davos. It was very warmly welcomed, because people believe that when the Communist Party of China, when the government is set on a certain goal, which is to transform China from a major productive house in the world into a consumer market, that's what they will accomplish. So that will bring a lot of opportunities and shared prosperity with other countries. And until and unless China finish that transition and continue to promote consumption on the one hand and becoming a more highly advanced technological country, I don't think we can fully realize the potential of this cooperation, newfound cooperation engagement between China and European countries. So I think you need both sides to work together.
Yeah. By the way, I watched a video that from Davos, actually three videos. One is our He Lifeng's speech. I think his speech was really great. He still talk about economic globalization, not fragmentation. And I think he said that we should not back to those isolationism. And we should focus on innovation-driven development. All those things are very good. A good point. And also Carney's speech, rupture of the international order, not transition. And the last but not the most important is Zhao Hai, your panel. that was really great. I think your conversation with then former Prime Minister Rudd, right? And that was good, very good. And back to the question, I think even about Ukraine, I think European side, more and more European colleagues have realized that China's policy to this very difficult issue has been consistent. And some of European colleagues have, of course, they would not say that publicly, but privately, they agree with China's position on Ukraine. And so I think Trump's policy has given China a very good opportunity to have use all those summit meetings, strategic dialogues, political dialogues to emphasize more about China's position and views and the reasons behind that in order to have more strategic empathy on both sides for the further improvement of China, EU, and European relations. I think definitely it's a very good opportunity.
Well, to tie all this threads together, I think, you know, there's a great political debate and also infighting in the United States. There's transition of transatlantic relationship. There's warming up of, you know, middle powers with China. And also we'll talk about the changing world order. So do you think, are we already in new international order or still stuck between the old one and whatever comes next? And no matter whether we are in new order or transition, how would you each very briefly describe the core feature of this emerging system, Dawei?
Yes, I very much agree with Prime Minister Carney, his view. I think we are already in a new international order. We are not in the transition. I think this transition started maybe, you know, it's hard to say which year, but I will say from 2017, when President Trump you know, started his first term. I think we had experienced about 8 years of transition. Now we are already in a new order. And the center characteristic of this new order is, I think it's nationalism. So the old order we experienced was the order started after the end of the Cold War, to, you know, very recent history. I think that was, you know, in the Western term, a liberal international order maintained, supported by one superpower. That is, you can say that's the U.S. or you can say the West. So it's kind of, you know, some kind of unipolar structure supported a multilateral liberal international order. But I think now the new structure is a nationalist order. And beneath this order, there are several multiple players. Someone say multi polar world. Some people are hesitant to use polarity, but there are several key players. So I think this is the new order, and it will continue for I don't know how long, but maybe for a period of time. And we will see, even let's imagine after 3 years, the U.S. have a new president in the White House, probably the economic nationalism will continue to be there. And the geopolitical, not a sphere of influence, but a more homeland-focused U.S. national security will be there. And other players, I think, quite naturally focus in the periphery of their own countries. So, I think the new, I put it again, I think the core characteristic is the nationalism.
Dawei is the expert. I'm not sure whether I have the answer, but my sense is that no matter we are in the old, still stuck in the old order, or we are in the new order now, I think for those major powers, their major challenges come from within. So they will focus more on their domestic things, challenges, and less interested about international institutions or global governance. And that has created much bigger room for other forces, whether you are middle powers or some groups or some high-tech person or creative companies, we don't know. But there
Superman,
are...
Superman, yeah.
Yeah, Superman. And that has caused much more unpredictability for the transformation of the old order or the new order. That's what's on my mind recently, yeah.
Zhaohai, what's your view on this? Yeah.
I think it's more likely that we'll have a super evil man than a Superman in this world order. My sense is that I want to use a word of, I mean, many scholars recently used this word called interregnum, which is sort of an intermission between the world orders. My personal belief is that we're not there yet. Because, if you want to have a new world order, you will have order first. Meaning that you have new norms, you have new rules, new regulations. But on the one hand, we're still living in this old order. If you go out travel, you can still feel it, right? The system's still there. However, we're looking at a beast that this order could be in disorder, and a lot of things are happening at the same time, disrupting the current order. However, what's coming next? Nobody knows. I met Ian Bremmer, Eurasia Group CEO at Davos, and he reiterated his judgment, which is that we're now in a G0 world. There's no G2. There's no G20. Nobody's taking responsibility. I partially agree with him, but I think he is a step too far, because you can still see the remnant of the old order and inertia of the old order. However, the new order is also emerging. It's just that it's not fully formed. The United States has taken the first shot, publishing the National Security Strategy, describing their vision of the new world order. And I think China has been describing the new world order by using the word of equitable, orderly, multipolar world. However, what does that mean in terms of building a real world order? People still trying to find out. And for the middle powers, Carney doctrine is quite a make a quite a big sound. However, what's in it exactly? How that kind of world will function? People still don't know. So my fear is that we're still probably. Many years away from reaching this new world order. In between, we will have continuous geopolitical instability, unpredictability, struggle, regional wars, conflicts, and the fragmentation of global trading system. However, hopefully, at the end of the tunnel, we will see another a reestablishment and a more inclusive, sustainable world order after the unipolar American hegemony. But at this present moment, again, I think for China, needs to maintain the current course. And I think the value of China has been realized by many countries because China's its own stability and its willingness to maintain stability in this chaotic world.
Yeah, great. I think the three of us provided our audience three answers to the question. Yuqun said she does not know. Zhao Hai said we are in a transition. And I said we are already in a new order. So let's. I think we can agree to disagree. But I think one thing we may all, maybe all of us agree that we have already departed from the old order. We are not at that position like in 1990s and 2000s. And I think it's very important to stop to be nostalgic. And we have to look forward. We have to look ahead. It's maybe not a rosy picture ahead, but we need to be realistic and observe the situation and try to manage it to avoid a very bad scenario. I think this is, I guess, all of us can agree. So with that, I will say thank you, Zhao Hai and Yuqun, for a truly insightful conversation. We have covered immense ground today, from Davos to the deep currents shaping transatlantic ties and the global order itself.
Absolutely. This dialogue has clarified many complex issues. I, for one, am keen to see how these themes develop at the upcoming Munich Security Conference, which Dawei will be attending.
Well, that's right. Perhaps we can have another conversation after Dawei return from Munich.
Okay, I'm happy to compare the notes by that time. Thank you for listening to Sinopinion, Chinese Perspective, Global Vision.
For more insights from Chinese scholarship on international affairs, please follow or subscribe to our podcast. Until next time.